Support for the Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, working to support students, educators, and public schools as the center of their communities through the Public Schools Unite Us initiative. It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm David Gustina. This week is a new guest. Joining us is Republican New York State Assemblyman Ed Rah. A Long Island native, Ed Rah was first elected to the New York State Assembly in 2010. His 19th district includes parts of the towns of Hempstead, North Hempstead, and Oyster Bay in Nassau County. And Assemblyman Rah serves as a ranking minority member of the Assembly Ways and Means Committee. Welcome to the Capital Connection, Assemblyman Ed Rah.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
It's your first time here on the program. Tell us a little bit more about yourself. Let the listeners across the state know a little bit more about you.
Absolutely. As you mentioned, I was first elected back in 2010, so 15 years have gone pretty quickly. But I grew up on Long Island in a town called Franklin Square, still live there today. I went to college down in Baltimore at Loyola, went to law school at St. John's. We've had an exciting year as a St. John's alum,
other than
the unfortunate, you know, going out early in the tournament last Saturday.
Well, everybody's brackets are busted by now, huh?
Yeah, but then I worked in local government for a couple years and got elected to the Assembly and have been here since. And I've had the opportunity to, in my earlier days, to serve on a number of very interesting committees, health, education, transportation, learning a lot. And then for the last 6 years, Leader Barclay has entrusted me to be our point person on the budget and be ranker on Ways and Means.
Yeah, and that brings us right to that budget discussion. I want to preface the budget discussion with something I've heard you talk about on the floor. I've talked to your leader, Will Barclay, about, and that is the fact that, you know, there was one time when I covered New York State politics that the Senate was in the majority. The
yes.
Republicans were in the majority. You remember Senate Majority Leader Joe Bruno, of course. But for years and years, the Senate had a Republican majority. We even had Governor Pataki for a time as a Republican governor. So the power structure was much different. Now the houses are controlled by the Democrats. The Democrat, Governor Hochul, is in the governor's seat. And so you have a lot less of an ability to impact change. But what I've heard you talking about and what I've heard Will Barclay talking about is listening to the ideas that you present in the chamber and bringing some of those ideas to the fore. We know, for example, in things like childcare, Will Barclay has told us, a lot of times what the Democrats do is take a lot of those good ideas and make them their own. So can you talk about what it's like to be in the minority at a time like this when you obviously have a major agenda in your minority conference?
Yeah, absolutely. So it is. It's very different. You know, my first 8 years here, you know, we had a Republican Senate. It had just flipped back in 2010 when I, after 2 years of them being in the minority when I first got elected. And yeah, there was a lot more of a forced compromise because you had a Republican Senate, Assembly was Democratic, Governor was Democratic. But, you know, especially when you got into the budget process or some of the, I would say, crazier ideas that we would see in our house, we knew weren't going anywhere down the hall. But I think our role, and we do it well, led by Leader Barclay, is to have our ideas. We take seriously. A lot of people think, hey, you're in the minority, you're going to put a bill together and just throw words on the paper. That's not how we work. We put a lot of thought into these things, and like you said, oftentimes they get picked up by majority members. I mean, you mentioned childcare. The governor has three pieces that were in the executive budget proposal this year that hopefully will be part of the final budget that are very similar to a child care agenda we put forth last year. You know, any number of ideas that we've seen over the years really do originate with our conference. And I think there's also, so there's the, I guess, bully pulpit end of it and being out there and being vocal about a lot of these issues. But there's also, you know, over time, the relationships you form with members in the majority, you know, having been here 15 years, I know who across the aisle is interested in a lot of the same things as me. So I can go over and have a conversation and say, hey, somebody came to me with this idea. I put a bill together. Would you take a look at it? And that's how, you know, you find partnerships that you can move forward on a lot of these issues that aren't partisan issues, right? We know at the end of the day, there are things that are partisan issues that I'm not going to get that cooperation. We're going to disagree on some of maybe the criminal justice stuff. But childcare, making New York State more affordable, there's a lot of areas for common ground.
Yeah, and I am guessing by the way you're talking here and your tone that it's a lot less vitriol than is happening in Washington, for example. You can actually have a conversation with your leaders, say Carl Hastie, or another member who's on the other side of the aisle and have a reasonable conversation.
Yeah, I think you can. And, you know, one of the things that is interesting, having been here a while now, you know, when I first got elected and it was Speaker Silver, it was like, I get on an elevator with him, it was eyes forward. I don't want this guy to even know my name.
My way or the
right?
highway?
Speaker Hastie is very different, having had the opportunity to serve with him as a rank and file member. I was on the Labor Committee when he was chair of Labor. And he's just a different guy. He leads in a different way, obviously leads his conference well, but has a different approach. You know, you see him, right? He's out on the floor a lot amongst his members. And both him and I would say his staff are accessible and you can have conversations with them, as well as many of, you know, the majority members who are leading some of the major committees.
We're talking with New York State Assemblyman Ed Ra, a Republican from Long Island. He is a ranking member on the Ways and Means Committee. You know, the idea of transparency is something you focus on. You want government to be transparent. But when it comes to this budget negotiation process, you know, we've heard for years, three people in a room negotiating the budget. Yes, there are conference committees. Yes, you guys communicate throughout the session. But isn't a lot of this negotiation and the final budget, a lot of it is in secret? New York citizens don't get a fair shot of what's happening when the big ugly comes due.
I would agree. The problem is, right, you have a process here which starts with the executive. We go through a series of budget hearings, which, you know, I'm there all day, every day for if I felt like I lived in a hearing room B for about a month in late January through almost the end of February. And then it kind of goes into the back rooms. And that's unfortunate because we're talking about $252 billion in the proposal. Final probably is going to be a little north of that. And so many interests that New Yorkers have that I think you don't know who's really weighing in on certain things when you're in a closed door negotiation. So you look at something that has been a big topic this year, but really it was a budget thing last year, was the CDPAP program.
Yeah, let's talk about that a little.
It didn't last year, really. It was kind of an 11th hour thing. And all of a sudden this was in the final budget. And, you know, it wasn't something that we had the opportunity to ask questions about at a budget hearing because it wasn't really on the table earlier on in the process. So those in particular, stuff like that, when something comes onto the table late in the process when we've already had our hearings and all that, those are particularly frustrating issues because you just want people to have the opportunity to say their piece. It doesn't necessarily mean they're going to get everything they want, but it's really important that stakeholders have an opportunity to weigh in on our budget and on our bills. And, you know, when things are being discussed behind closed doors, it just doesn't allow for that.
Yeah. And when we're talking about CDPAP, we're talking about home assistance, right? Just explain to the listeners what that program is.
So this is a program that is designed to really allow whether they're older New Yorkers, disabled individuals, to live independently. So they can hire what's called a personal assistant. And it's, you know, funded through Medicaid. And that person can help them with their daily tasks that they need to be able to live independently. The governor identified that the growth in the program has been large, and it has, but that she was concerned with fraud. Now, a lot of us felt like, okay, let's put some new safeguards in place, deal with the fraud. But what happened was in last year's budget, we decided there's over 600 of these what were called fiscal intermediaries that basically act as the middleman, deal with making sure that the personal assistants get paid between the health coverage and paying the individual. So now we're going to go down to a single fiscal intermediary, which is supposed to be fully implemented and transitioned by April 1st of this year. Mm-hmm. And it has not been going all that well in terms of enrolling the individuals. The governor just Sunday night and then formally on Monday came out and said, we're going to put a little 30-day grace period into place so that we get people transitioned. To me, at the end of the day, it's about making sure that there's a continuity of care and making sure these individuals get care. And it is about the people. But if you want to talk about it from a financial standpoint, if these individuals don't have these personal assistants, a lot of them are going to end up in a much more expensive setting, a nursing home or some other institutional care where it's going to be much more expensive to care for them.
Thank you for explaining that. Assemblyman Ed Rah, Republican, joining us on the Capitol Connection this week. Well, speaking of pauses, the president has paused what he wants to do, which is to shut down the congestion pricing plan in New York City. I know the Republicans, both in the Assembly and the Senate, don't like this plan. And even some Democrats have come out against it. People like James Skoufitz and others who see it as a tax on New Yorkers. But the MTA has this huge hole that needs to be filled, and part of that was the congestion pricing plan. You already mentioned Medicaid. We're seeing what's happening on the federal level with DOGE and the cuts. So you really have some uncertainty, don't we, in terms of, for example, just congestion pricing in the MTA. What's going to happen to the MTA? And I know people like Congressman Lawler and others have said they've mismanaged this money all along. Billions have been lost. It hasn't been handled well. But the truth is, at the same time, we need to fund the MTA, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, let me say that at the outset. Like, as a Long Islander, the MTA is essential for downstate, for our economy, for people to be able to get to, medical appointments, all of those things. And to just take advantage of the, you know, cultural institutions we have in New York City as well. So we do need to make sure the MTA is properly funded, make sure the capital plan is properly funded. But what I hear from constituents all the time is when they hear about something like congestion pricing, or they hear about some new proposal to provide additional funding to the MTA, they say, well, why am I always hearing about them coming back? There's always, it seems like every few years, there's a big hole that has to be filled. But then I read about scandals. I read about overtime abuse. I read about how much more they're paying for construction and cost overruns and all that type of stuff. So I think that people want to see that addressed before they put more money into it. Now, congestion pricing, the problem to me is it tried to be two things at once. Was it about reducing the congestion or was it about the revenue? At the very outset, the talk was we need to raise $1 billion for the MTA capital plan. And really, if you read the letter that came from the Trump administration, that's what they talked about, is that, you know, the waiver that was granted by the Biden administration was under a statute that allows for a program designed to reduce congestion. But even if you go back and look at the language that was in the 2019 budget, the first thing it talks about is money for the MTA. Then it talks about reducing congestion. So I think those were always two competing goals of congestion pricing. And at the end of the day, I view it as another way of getting money from suburban commuters' wallets.
Well, and then the question is, if that money doesn't come from there, where will it come from? And we're already hearing the Assembly Speaker talk about revenue raisers or what some might call tax raising.
I don't know exactly what has gone on behind closed doors, but I talked about back in 2010 when the Senate flipped back. One of the pivotal issues that flipped two Senate seats on Long Island that put Republicans back in the majority was the MTA payroll tax that had been implemented. And a couple of Democratic senators from Long Island, I think, signed their death warrants when they voted for that, because it was a tax on businesses. It was a tax on jobs. And it seems like, you know, a couple years ago, the MTA said, hey, we have an operating budget hole, and they wanted to put a higher rate on the MTA payroll tax. And it ended up in the final budget, it ended up going just to New York City and not, the surrounding areas in the MTA region. So, I mean, I'm concerned if that's what the discussion is, that you know, we're going to go back and put that higher rate on other areas, because I think it's a step backwards, because the MTA payroll tax, again, it's a payroll tax. It's a tax on jobs. And New York State struggles as it is in terms of attracting businesses and attracting jobs. And I don't think this is the time to do that.
Well, you know, all of this leads to the question of whether or not we'll end up in a special session, with the uncertainty that we're talking about from Washington and what will happen to New York. And I'm wondering if you think that's sort of an inevitability at this point.
Well, the majorities are obviously talking about it. It's been in the news the last few days. Would I say it's inevitable? I don't know if it's inevitable, but as we're discussing this budget, I think there are things that we can do to be smart and preparing in case we do have some tough decisions to make later in the year. And I know that, you know, I'm hearing on the Democratic side, you know, they keep saying, hey, go talk to the Republican Congress people and all that. But one House budget comes out a couple weeks ago. The Assembly majority drove up spending another $4 billion above the governor's proposal, dipped into the reserves that we've built up to the tune of $4 billion, and created a situation with their spending that the out-year budget deficit would be $10 billion more than it had been on the governor's proposal, $38 billion in out-year gaps. Those are three things I don't think you can do if you're worried about what's coming next. I think we need to, in this final budget, be smart about trying to make sure we have a manageable out year number, because, you know, if you have to make cuts in this budget year, you're also going to have to deal with the out years, and also preserving our reserves so that if we do need them, they're there. That's what they're supposed to be there for, not just to, you know, drive some additional spending.
Well, let me ask you this, Assemblyman Ed Rah, if the $20 billion gets stripped out of Medicaid, what happens in New York? Isn't that rainy day fund there for a reason?
Yeah, well, it should be there for a rainy day, not for just we decided we wanted to spend a little more in the budget this year. You know, it should be there for a rainy day. And look, that's the big concern. Medicaid is obviously the largest
Sure.
piece of our budget. And, you know, when you deal with a program like that, you know, in New York State, we have the local share, which has in larger and larger pieces over the years come to the state side of it. But you have the federal match, and it's part of why we have such an expensive Medicaid program, is that, you know, you're able to leverage those federal dollars in a lot of these areas. So, yeah, the Medicaid side of it is my biggest concern. But again, that's why we need to preserve our reserves so that if we do need to figure out some difficult choices later in the year, that we have them.
Assemblyman Ed Rah, let's move on to criminal justice issues. I know that you have been one of the leaders in the area of bail reform. We've seen a number of local district attorneys, including the former Democratic District Attorney of Albany, talking about discovery and the problems with having to provide so much in discovery evidence. Also, the idea that we need judges to be able to have discretion when they evaluate, let's say, somebody's dangerousness if they're going to give them bail. And it seems like the governor is hearing your calls for this and seems to be moving in a direction to allow more discretion by judges.
Yeah. And look, I hope, you know, she has this discovery change in her executive budget. I hope she holds firm on it. Certainly she has support of us on our side of the aisle with regard to that. You know, there's been concerns from DAs all over the state, whether they're in some of these smaller counties that just don't have the resources to meet some of these, and even a larger county like mine in Nassau. And on the bail side of it, you know, every other state has a dangerousness standard. We don't. And I think that would help, because what it functions really is as a catch-all. Right now, a judge does not have the full ability to evaluate the case in front of them. It's just, is this crime bail eligible or is it not? And if it's not, they don't have any discretion to set bail. And I know, you know, our DA Ann Donnelly was up here talking about this issue, because they want to pursue justice, be fair. But what we're talking about really is a small number of recidivist offenders that judges feel like their hands are tied to really doing what they think is in the best interest of public safety.
And yet there still is a problem with the bail system, isn't there? When you find people who can't afford wallow in prison cells longer than they should be.
Yeah, I think that having adequate discretion allows the judge to see, okay, this person made a mistake. This is not a person with a, you know, years and years long rap sheet. You know, setting a high bail on them that they can't afford is not going to benefit anybody, because what's going to happen? They're going to lose their job. And that's how that person goes down that rabbit hole of now becoming somebody that is trapped in the criminal justice system. So the intent at the end of the day was good. It was something that I think we all support, which is being fair in those type of situations, but also making sure of public safety. And I think we just swung the pendulum too far.
Will it be swinging the pendulum too far if involuntary commitment goes through? This is controversial. I mean, yes, we've had some disturbing incidents, for example, on the subway, where someone who obviously isn't quite in their right mind pushes someone to their death. Or in one case, someone set an illegal immigrant, in fact, set a woman on fire on a train. These kinds of things are scary. They call for better public safety. And yet we have to be careful, right, don't we, when we start deciding on the spot that somebody needs to be removed?
Yeah, it is a very difficult issue where you draw that line for, you know, a person who can't provide the basic necessities for themselves, right? So I think that, you know, what the governor is trying to do is say, here's an individual that is not well, is not able to provide the basic necessities, shelter, clothing, food for themselves, and we need to get them in and get them help so that they do not harm themselves or others. So it's a difficult conversation, and obviously there's a lot of legal, constitutional interplay there that
civil
has
liberties
to happen. But we clearly have a problem, right? We've seen some really, really disturbing incidents, and we're trying to do something that is in the best interest of these individuals. It's not about taking away their freedom. You know, it's about getting them help and hopefully getting them to a place where they can provide those necessities for themselves.
Yeah, especially if they are causing harm to others in a, quote, civil society. And then you have the issue of this mask ban, another controversial issue where the ACLU and others are up in arms over this. And this has to do with the idea of banning masks at protests and in public, which followed the pro-Palestinian encampments at Columbia University. And the governor called for this ban during a CNN interview. Progressive lawmakers are against it. What do you make of this?
Well, I think one thing people need to remember is this was the law in New York State for decades. You weren't allowed to cover your face in those settings. And then during the pandemic, people said, hey, this is kind of outdated. We're in a situation where people are out in public masked, and we don't want to have the possibility that somebody's going to get charged with a crime for trying to protect their health. So
for going in a bank with a mask on.
So that at the time made sense. But now you see these protests, and a lot of people do, you know, that seems to be how people are instructed to go and cover their face at these protests so they can't be identified. As you may know, in Nassau County, County Executive Blakeman did a mask ban locally.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, doing it at the state level, I think we should do it. I think if you put adequate safeguards in, that if somebody wants to wear one for their health, it's not about in any way stopping somebody from doing that. It should be done in a way that, right, you've done so in the furtherance of some other offense, and you can be charged for that. That, you know, it's not about taking away people's ability to wear one for medical reasons, whether you're immunocompromised or whether you're just concerned. You know, obviously, hey, we're coming out of winter now, right? But if you haven't been sick in the last few months, God bless you, because I feel like everybody has. But it's about those people that are intentionally masking to conceal their identities so that they can engage in some of this conduct that we've seen on these campuses, which has included both violence toward individuals and property destruction and intimidation of our Jewish students, which we need to do everything we can to prevent.
Well, let's talk a little bit about what I think there is in the budget a wide agreement on, and it's some sort of cell phone ban in schools. You know, the idea here is you ban it either bell to bell, or you provide maybe a lunch period or free period. I assume you're mostly supportive of this?
Generally, yes, but I think it needs enough flexibility that the local schools can implement it the way that they think works best. Because a lot of them have done it and, you know, are doing this already. And the bell-to-bell language, I think, would mean they have to completely change what they've been doing and what they feel they've been doing successfully. But I think a goal everybody shares, when we were younger, I mean, it's a terrible thing regardless, but, right, somebody's bullying you in school, but you go home and it doesn't follow you home. Now, when it's going on online, it's a totally different story. And as you know, New York State took some pretty, you know, bold and I would say, you know, we were ahead of the curve with this in terms of social media and algorithms and all that last year. And I think this follows the same type of intent to prevent young people from the harmful impacts of phones and that being such a pervasive thing in their life that they have to always be glued to their phones. But I just think we need adequate flexibility so the schools can implement it.
Well, we're running out of time quickly. I want to ask you another question, and it has to do, and there's so much to talk about with you, Edra. I hope I can get you to come back.
Absolutely.
And talk with again. The Assembly, for example, has just released a human trafficking report as we speak today. I hope we can get into that the next time, because you guys spent quite a bit of time investigating that issue and have a number of recommendations, including potential bills. But again, this overarching issue, and I want to bring this up because he's a Long Island native, Lee Zeldin is running the EPA right now. And I was a little shocked in that it's called the Environmental Protection Agency. But when he made his speech, his video release speech, I didn't hear anything about protection of the environment in there. He's a New Yorker, and I always thought that agency was supposed to protect the environment, not remove regulations. And then you have this issue of there are no borders when it comes to the world heating up. You know, New York is not separate just because it has borders. And those plants that New York is downwind of that sent all that pollution over here in that acid rain, that has been dealt with in legislation and has been protected. Are you worried at all about what's happening there and what it could mean for New York?
Well, I look back to the last Trump administration, and what often happened was if something was relaxed at the federal level, some type of legislation happened at the state level to kind of, you know, put it back or put different restrictions. I think there are things that are out there in terms of regulations that have inhibited businesses that have frustrated, I would say, local governments. I just met with one of my local mayors, you know, trying to deal with on the water side, PFAS, 1,4-dioxane, you know, treating all that, lead service lines. They want to do these things, but the federal government is in the past, or the state as well, has kind of come down hard on them, and they're trying to figure out how to deal with the cost of it. New York State, I would say, has been great with regard to, we did this Clean Water Infrastructure Act, and we've routinely put about $500 million in each budget and helping with addressing a lot of those issues. I'd like to see that number actually go up a little bit in this budget so that we can deal directly with service lines, because we passed a bill a few years ago that required us to identify all that stuff. So now the residents say, hey, I have a lead service line. Bring water into my house.
Yeah.
What am I going to do about that? So we have a service line replacement program that we've put very little money into. So that's where I'd like to see the additional spending there. But I think we need to work together with the federal government. Look, I know Administrator Zeldin well. We got elected to the state legislature the same year. He is a Long Islander, and I think Long Islanders always have a vested interest in preserving our environment.
Well, let's hope that there is some sort of move to provide better enforcement, because one of the things, even in the New York State, the Department of Environmental Conservation, which Governor Hochul recently said, because of the announcement by Zeldin, we need to be more vigilant in New York State. But the DEC already doesn't have enough bodies to do its regular work. Right?
Well, and I think that's been a concern with, we seem to pass a very major, at least one, if not multiple, environmental laws in New York every year. And I mean, that's the question we keep asking. Can the DEC handle this? Do they have the manpower to handle this? You know, we just, last year was the Superfund Act. You know, they're going to have to go through and dig through all of this data from the last basically 30 years to figure out who needs to pay into that and administer the funds and all of that. We're putting a lot on them. And I do think they probably could use some additional resources.
He is Assemblyman Ed Rah, joining us on the Capitol Connection this week, a Long Island Assemblyman on the Ways and Means Committee. You're a good guy for coming into the radio station and sitting down and speaking with me face to face on the Capitol Connection. And Ed, I hope that you'll come back again next time.
I would love to. It was a pleasure.
Thank you. Support for the Capitol Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, working to support students, educators, and public schools as the center of their communities through the Public Schools Unite Us initiative.